Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Always a great pleasure, and I count it a privilege to meet you here and have these conversations, really seeking to bring the headline news of the day, not only into conversation with our own thoughts and ideas and convictions and faith perspectives, but actually find ourselves equipped to then enter into the conversations of the day in ways that are faithful to what the scriptures reveal about the character and will of God, and then also faithful to the character of Christ. Like, how would Christ go about entering into the conversations of our day full of both grace and truth? Okay, I got to tell you that I just, with you, heard that news at the top of the hour, and I'm thinking to myself about this Lifeway research and what it reveals and what it says about us. And I, like you, have not had time to even interact with this material. It's literally just been posted. So I Googled it, and here's the headline. Many churchgoers want to worship with people who share their politics. My political views match those of most people at my church. That's the question that was asked. 51% of respondents said they agree that their political views are shared by the people around them in their pews. Well, that also means that 49% either don't know or disagree with that assessment. And so this is going to be a conversation that we're going to have to return to next week. But I'm going to throw it out there as something for you to be thinking about over the weekend. I promise you we will return to this subject because, we recognize that we live in a politically polarized culture. We also recognize that we are ambassadors of the kingdom of heaven in the midst of the kingdoms of this earth, and that it's incumbent upon us as believers to be influencing the culture. And so maybe it's not a surprise that we find ourselves in the context of worshiping congregations where either our political ideologies are reinforced or where we understand what's being taught from the scriptures and the way those scriptures are being taught, to already align with our political positions. I mean, that may be one way to think about this. Again, I haven't dug into the research yet, but I promise to dig in over the weekend. Hey, also, I'm going to be attending an event tomorrow that I'm just going to ask for your prayers in advance. I view it as really essential and important that we get out there into the mix of what's happening in our communities and in the culture, when that means attending events where, I absolutely expect to be the only person in the room tomorrow that holds the particular view of scripture that I hold, that holds the particular view of many things, many ideas in the culture and certainly political views. And so anyway, I'm going to the Christian Transhumanist Conference. And so these are people who actually believe and are advocating that it is, it's not Gnosticism, it's actually Christian, they would advocate, to think of the person as a disembodied reality. And so we're not talking here about the soul. We're talking here about the actual physical mind and the contents of your mind. And they want to see artificial intelligence and virtual reality technologies used to extend indefinitely the life of human beings who obviously could afford to have themselves, quote unquote, downloaded into some digital form that would survive beyond the survival of their physical body. You and I are going to have a whole conversation about that next week, but I want to give them their due and actually listen to their arguments tomorrow, to their presentations tomorrow, and I'll bring you that next week as well. I want to share with you, I'm sure that you have already heard that Senator John McCain has opted to suspend any further medical treatments. And I'll just read it from the Associated Press announcement. McCain's family says he's stopping medical treatments. As you read through the article, the dateline on this is Washington. John McCain, the six-term Arizona senator, Republican presidential nominee in 2008, has chosen to discontinue medical treatment for his brain cancer, his family said on Friday. In a statement, the family said McCain has surpassed expectations for survival, but, quote, the progress of disease and the inexorable advance of age render their verdict, end quote. The family added, quote, with his usual strength of will, he has now chosen to discontinue medical treatment. He'll be 82 next week, and he has been away from the Capitol since December. You will recognize John McCain as a former U.S. Navy pilot. He was held as a prisoner of war in Vietnam for more than 5 years, and he has lived his life with serious consequences of that particular time that he spent interred as a prisoner of war. He was elected to Congress in the early 1980s, elected to the Senate in 1986, which is the year I graduated from high school. So pretty much my entire adult life, John McCain has been a person in national leadership who I've recognized, and I've got family who live in Arizona. So he's somebody who has been in the mix of the conversation. And really, no matter where you come down on the conversation about politics and John McCain's particular political decisions and even decisions of late, certainly he is a man of valor, and certainly he is a person for whom we need to be giving great thanksgiving for his life of service to our nation, not only in a time of war, but in a time of great cultural upheaval over the course of many, many years. So certainly praying the news today, praying with and for John McCain's family. And I think that it's, you know, at some point we have to ask ourselves, how do we pray for those who are prepared to die? It sounds as if John McCain has made his peace with this decision. And so it brings up for me the conversation of how do we pray when we're asked to pray for things that, you know, maybe we feel led to pray in ways different than we're being asked. And I raise this because this is actually a challenge for me personally. And I just had an experience earlier this morning of being asked to pray over social media, but being asked to pray, someone asking me specifically to pray for kids to be protected and liberated from drugs and human trafficking. That's absolutely a reasonable thing to be praying for. But when I prayed, I included prayers for those who are preying on the most vulnerable. I was praying that those who prey upon predator kinds of praying, those who are preying upon our children, that those people would be convicted of their sin, that they would experience genuine conversion and redemption, that you know, recognizing that changed people change cultures. And so I was praying in that way. And the person who asked me to pray had asked me to pray to protect kids and liberate them from drugs and human trafficking, and basically interrupted me and was like, that's not how I asked you to pray. And I said, well, so I can pray that kids would be protected, but if I'm not praying that those who are preying upon our kids be changed, then I'm not dealing with the underlying systemic issues in the culture that are really causing, you know, kids to be led into this kind of temptation, sin, and death. Like, I got to pray that the enemy would be bound on the side of those who want to be doing these things to kids, not just on the side of the protecting the kid. And so it was an interesting conversation. I was clearly not praying in the way that this person wanted me to pray. So I just lift that up to you, because if you're like me, you find yourself being asked to pray for things on occasion that that you just really have trouble praying for. Every time I'm asked to pray, obviously by somebody who is in distress and has a heartfelt need, let's say for a child to receive a needed organ transplant, I recognize in the midst of that prayer that I am asking God to take the life of a currently healthy child, that healthy organ might be made available to a terminally ill child who needs an organ transplant. I'm conflicted when I'm asked to pray that way. And so I just lift that up to you. And so let us be praying today in the will of God. Let us be praying as Jesus instructed, that God's kingdom would come and God's will would be done on earth as it is in heaven. Okay, friends, right after the break, I'm going to bring to you a conversation that I was privileged to have actually 2 weeks ago with Ken Starr. You will recognize the name Ken Starr, former U.S. Circuit Judge, U.S. Solicitor General. You will remember him as the independent counsel charged with investigating then-President Bill Clinton. The infamous Starr report resulted in impeachment proceedings. This is a timely conversation, I recorded this 2 weeks ago, which is why you're not going to hear me ask specific questions in relationship to the headline news of the last 24 or 48 hours where the word impeachment might have come up. So anyway, that's what's coming up next. It's a timely conversation with Ken Starr. I'm your host, Carmen LeBurge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I am particularly privileged today to introduce to you Ken Starr. You know him probably best from his service as Solicitor General under President George W. Bush. You may remember that he served as independent counsel while Bill Clinton was president. You may also know him as the president and chancellor of Baylor University from 2010 to 2016. He is an author. He obviously is an attorney. He was a federal court judge in the Court of Appeals. And I'm just privileged to have him here today as a fellow, a person who is also concerned about liberty and justice for all. So Ken Starr, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thank you, Carmen.
So word on the street, by the way, is that you have a book coming out.
Oh, so, the word on the street is right for a change. I certainly do.
So I would like to know what the title of the book is and when we might all anticipate it.
Thank you. The title of the book is Contempt, a memoir of the Clinton investigation. So it's my personal story about living through those tumultuous years in the 1990s and the lessons that I think we the people can draw from that wrenching historical experience. It issues the week of September 10, but it can be pre-ordered immediately on Amazon or wherever books are sold.
So if I just go to Amazon and I just Google Contempt, it's what's going to come up. I'm just letting you know right now. So friends, the book is Contempt. We really can't talk any more about it today, but there we will all be excited to anticipate its release and reading it. And then maybe we'll have the opportunity to talk with you again about what's in it.
Thank you. I would like that.
That'd be fun. Okay, so but let's talk about Brett Kavanaugh. You know him. You all had the opportunity to work together. People across the country recognize him as the current nominee for the vacancy created on the Supreme Court by the retirement of Justice Kennedy. Tell us something about Brett Kavanaugh that you think we should know, and maybe something about your shared service.
Well, I think the nation is already coming to appreciate that he is a great human being, a wonderful person, a person of very strong faith. Most relevantly, he's a person of great integrity who is committed to the original meaning of the Constitution and to the text of laws as Congress and other legislatures pass them as they're enacted into law. He is a judge who believes in judicial restraint. Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 78 at the time of the founding said, don't worry about the judges. They're going to behave themselves. That is the branch of government where judgment and not will, in other words, policy determinations are made. Well, Colonel Hamilton may have a musical written about him, and it's wildly popular, but his crystal ball was a little cloudy. Because power does corrupt, and all too frequently, judges, including, frankly, the Supreme Court of the United States, have exercised power in the sense of will, imposing the will of the judge or justices on we the people. Brett Kavanaugh is not that kind of judge.
So you've used some words that come up frequently in these conversations, but might not be words that people across the country necessarily use on an everyday basis. When you talk about Judge Kavanaugh being concerned about the original language, or when you describe him as a person, you didn't even use this word, but I think what you were alluding to is his commitment to the respect of precedent. Tell us what that means in terms of actually doing the work of a judge.
It means you would look to the text of the Constitution, the structure of the Constitution. For example, the term separation of powers is not there, but you draw the inference that we have a separated powers system from the structure of the Constitution, and then the history of the Constitution, including, as I just alluded to and mentioned, the Federalist Papers and the other materials that help us understand what did the founding generation mean when it crafted this document and ratified it, and that you take that seriously as opposed to a jumping-off point as an opportunity for the judge to impose his or her policy preferences in terms of social policy and the like, and to simply have great respect for what legislatures, including what Congress, does. Now, are there limits? Of course, and those limits are found in the constitutional amendments. So Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So a textualist, originalist judge would say, wait a second, Congress just passed a law that says that no faith-based institution can apply for any federal grant, even though it is engaged in social services, let's say a Catholic hospital or a Baptist hospital or whatever. You're excluded because you are faith-affiliated. The textualist would look and say, well, wait a second. It looks as if you've created tension with both the Establishment Clause, because you seem to be singling out religion, faith, for unfavorable treatment. And along the way, you're also probably Congress violating the Free Exercise Clause. I use this as a strained hypothetical example to just show the process that a textualist, originalist judge like Judge Kavanaugh, hopefully Justice Kavanaugh, would go through.
So, friends, you are listening to the voice of Ken Starr. I feel like you don't need any other designation than that.
Grandpa.
Grandpa. See, there you go. We're just going to refer to him as Grandpa Ken Starr here today. But he's also an author, and he offers, I feel like, very frank commentary on some of the things happening today when you're asked to do so, and I certainly appreciate that.
Thank you.
I will resist asking specific questions about your view of the current Mueller investigation. And instead, what I will ask is, okay, as a person who has had in your own life the experience of investigating a sitting president, help us understand what the role of a person in that position is, and what sort of liberty or freedom there is in terms of the breadth of things that that individual might be looking at.
Well, the job is to do the job that's given to you.
Because you were given one job, and then your job was expanded.
Yes, it was. But I did not expand the job. It was expanded by those who controlled the authority to determine what I would be looking at and what my colleagues and I would be looking at. So just to get to the most controversial phase of the investigation, the Monica Lewinsky phase was expressly authorized by Janet Reno, the then Attorney General under President Clinton, and then by a three-judge panel of the United States Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. So you had those two checks, those two balances. And so if it were said, oh, my goodness, that independent prosecutor, independent counsel, is out looking at things that he or she has no business looking at, well, go check. Go check the job description. Go check the charter, the mandate, because it might surprise you to know that specific express authorization was, in fact, granted. So that's the basic answer. You're to go look at and examine and determine whether crimes were committed in that grant, the original grant, or then any follow-up grants. So just a brief comment about Bob Mueller. There's a different structure now in place in that Bob Mueller, famously, was appointed by Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein as the acting Attorney General. The mechanism under the old independent counsel law, under which I was appointed, has gone away. So there are no courts doing the appointing. It's the Justice Department, the Attorney General, or the acting Attorney General. That's a big difference in terms of accountability. We can all say, well, if Bob Mueller is not doing his job, then that's Rod Rosenstein's obligation as the acting Attorney General to step in and stop him, redirect him, or discharge him.
All right, so one final question, and thank you for being so gracious with your time today. I really appreciate it.
No, my pleasure.
you are a person of faith. I think people are aware of that. You've been very public about that. Talk to our listeners who are Christians across the country about trends that you see in terms of the experiences of Christians or people of faith in general in the United States. Maybe how things are different today than they were when you were in your 20s.
Well, I look to the hills whence cometh my help. Carmen, we have been focusing a lot here over these last few days on the Supreme Court of the United States. You, of course, have mentioned Judge Kavanaugh, who I hope will become Justice Kavanaugh. And the Supreme Court of the United States has been a wonderful check on the increased secularization, which is what I see, the increased hostility, which is what I see, to people of faith in the public square. In case after case after case, the Supreme Court, not infrequently by super majorities, such as the Jack Phillips masterpiece cake shop case. This is a wonderful example of the Supreme Court of the United States stepping in by a 7-2 vote and telling, in that instance, the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, you have evinced hostility to religion and religious belief, freedom of conscience, and sort of shame on you. You can't do that in this country. And over again, the Supreme Court has been a, shall I say, a protector, a shield for religious faith. Last year, it was Trinity Lutheran Church seeking to participate in a program whereby playgrounds could use reprocessed tires to make playgrounds safer. Perfectly fine. It wasn't as if we'll pay the pastor's salary here out of tax funds. It was simply enabling the faith-based school to participate to make its playground safer. Again, it was an overwhelming victory for religious freedom. So there are these secularizing pressures. Sometimes there are state constitutions that are very separationist and have the effect of making it more difficult for religious institutions and the like to participate in programs that they should be able to participate on the same equal footing as anyone else. We know, thou shalt not discriminate. Well, sometimes churches and religiously based institutions and so forth are the subjects of discrimination. So there have been very encouraging signs year after year from the Supreme Court of the United States.
Hey, friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. This is actually a pre-recorded conversation I had the privilege of engaging with Ken Starr a couple of weeks ago. He actually went ahead and gave us a whole nother segment of time. So when we come back from the break, you're going to hear more of my conversation with Ken Starr. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge. Friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I am joined again by Ken Starr. We are going to avoid some topics of conversation in order that we can focus in here. And let me remind you that if you want to pre-order Contempt, a memoir of the Clinton investigation by Ken Starr, which releases on September the 11th, you can do so at Amazon.com. So, Ken, let's actually return to our conversation about Brett Kavanaugh.
Very good.
So, just tell us what his reputation is on the Court of Appeals.
He's served for 12 years, and his reputation is outstanding. He's respected across the spectrum as being a very careful judge who tries to get it right, who doesn't manipulate the facts, who doesn't manipulate the law. There are articles to the effect of sometimes he rules in favor of business and sometimes he rules against. Sometimes he rules in favor of the Environmental Protection Agency. Sometimes he rules against. Well, that's sort of to be expected of a good and lawful judge who's simply trying to, as John Roberts said, and the Chief Justice in his confirmation hearings, to call balls and strikes. We want our referees and our umpires to be honest, to give it their best. It doesn't mean they're going to agree on everything. What is the meaning of freedom of speech? Does that include flag burning? Well, you know, I'd say, well, of course it doesn't. Well, Antonin Scalia would say, yes, it does, because of his interpretation of the First Amendment. So not everyone who is a, quote, conservative or a textualist or a liberal or progressive is going to come to exactly the same answer with his or her colleagues. But are they going about the process in a predictable and professional way in what I call the grand tradition of constitutional law, which is judges, you don't run the country. Allow Congress, the state legislatures, and so forth to run the country, and you protect our separation of powers, you protect our federal republic and the rights of the states, and then you protect our precious freedoms enshrined in the Bill of Rights. But don't make it up. That's the cardinal sin, making it up. Well, I think it would be better if, for example, if every educational system in the United States spent exactly the same money across the United States of America. I think the Equal Protection Clause, I'm making this up, I think the Equal Protection Clause requires that. Well, that would be so unmoored from the history and traditions of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment as to lead one to the reasonable conclusion that judge is just making it up to build a better society. We all want a better society, but who makes these basic decisions, the legislatures or the judges?
Which I think gets us to a conversation about the role of government. And people, I think, in our culture today have very different views of the role of government. And I think that when we talk about the division in our culture, that's one of the most basic divisions. Is the role of government narrow, or is the role of government very expansive? And so I think that when we have the conversation about judges and what kinds of judges we want or expect or desire, it does ultimately go back to a conversation about what is the role of government and what do we think good judgment looks like.
Well, and the starting place is, well, let's turn to the text of the Constitution. Let's look at the powers of government. Let's look at Article 1, Section 8, the powers of the Congress. Let's then look at Article 1, Section 9, that is the thou shalt not clause or section with a number of clauses. What about the power of the president? Well, let's go to the text. Let's look at Article 2 of the – so you begin with the text, and that's the beginning place. It's not going to necessarily answer all questions. Did Thomas Jefferson exceed his authority in sending the Marines to Tripoli so they could have a great Marine fight song, right? Did he exceed his authority without going to Congress? How about Thomas Jefferson authorizing the purchase of Louisiana without specific congressional authorization? Those are neat questions that if you read Article 2, you'll say, I don't know. So judgment is going to be exercised, but these are the kinds of questions that a thoughtful judge would now look at in terms of presidential power. The Trump travel ban, where do you begin? You begin with the powers of the president. You then look at the statute, and where the court was deeply divided over the Trump travel ban was, what is the meaning of this statute that Congress passed and has been on the books for a long time? And I think the better reading of the statute is the president has the power to do what he did. Argue it in terms of, is it wise policy? Is this smart? Is it not smart? But it's authorized. So that's why we have elections. Congress chose to give the president a lot of power over trade and over immigration. I don't mean the president of the United States now occupying the office. The presidency enjoys that power. So is the court going to allow Congress to do what it did, or is it going to step in and say, I think I found a reason to overturn the president's travel ban, and what kind of judge do we want, or justice do we want? I want one who's going to go by the law, and that's the kind of justice Brett Kavanaugh is.
So let's talk about maybe some of the things that views he's likely to express based on the way you have seen him decide cases in the past, because he has written a lot. Like he's he's not one of those judges who, you know, just signs his name onto somebody else's work, right? He seems
exactly.
to really want to do his own work. And so let's take religious freedom as just one area of the law. What kinds of expectations would you have if he were to be on the Supreme Court and he were to have the opportunity to hear a religious liberty or religious freedom case?
Well, here's an insight. When I returned to my law firm, and I practiced law with then Brett Kavanaugh, future Judge Kavanaugh, I wander in his office, and I've just written my book on the Supreme Court of the United States, and I'm teaching at NYU and at George Mason and so forth. And, hey, Brett, what are you working on? I should say, hey, future Judge Kavanaugh, what are you working on? Well, he was doing it, he did it all by himself. He said, hey, you need any help? Because he was working on a very interesting religious liberty case. It was called Good News Club versus Milford. Can the Good News Club, which is a volunteer group or parents going into the schools, elementary schools, ages 6 to 12 of the kids, after school, and it essentially is a wanna. You know, they learn a Bible verse, they sing a song, and so forth. So it is essentially a Bible club after hours. And the Supreme Court, not surprisingly, upheld this against a challenge, you know, secularism and so forth. And we all believe in the idea of religious freedom, which means the state is not to interfere with the church, right? And the church is not to interfere with the state. And he was writing this brief, and it was a wonderful friend of the court brief on behalf of the Good News Club. So that's an insight into Brett Kavanaugh, the real person. So you can go and pull it up on the internet, Brett Kavanaugh's brief, and guess what? He authored it all by himself. No one else is on the brief. I mean, somebody from Louisiana is on the brief as local
so
counsel.
So, see, it's good that we purchased Louisiana so that he'd have somebody to write with.
This, you know, see, Thomas Jefferson was looking ahead.
It's a fully integrated conversation.
Carmen, I'm the smarter when I talk to you and listen to your questions. You're exactly right. Thank you, Mr. Jefferson.
Okay, so tell us what you think. Well, what's your sense of things in terms of the confirmation process?
Well, the confirmation process will unfold in these remaining summer months, perhaps on into early fall. The goal still is, as I think everyone knows, to have Justice Kavanaugh duly confirmed and sworn in time to sit on the first Monday in October, which happens to be October 1 rather than October 7th. So the Senate has its work cut out for him. I'm very pleased that the courtesy calls on the various senators thus far have gone swimmingly. Everybody loves Brett. Excuse me, Judge Kavanaugh. And that's because he's a lovable, likable guy, that you would go have a sarsaparilla with him or perhaps something else, the kind of person who you just enjoy being around, who's not full of himself. People talk about his humility. You know, he's the smartest kid in the class kind of person, Yale College, Yale Law School. But notwithstanding that training, he's very smart and he's very thoughtful. That was just kidding. I don't want the Yale people to get upset. He's a very, very able person who's just fun to be around. And that's one of the reasons his colleagues love him. He's a great colleague.
So I'm a Princeton person, so I'll just be equally offended. I know.
Go Tigers.
There you go. Okay, so I have a grandpa question.
Shoot.
Okay, so first of all, what do your grandkids call you?
Because Grandpa.
All right, and do they?
I'm in the union, the grandpa union.
Okay, so is Alice in the grandma union?
Of course.
Are you are? Because
yeah.
I'm grandma. I'm Grandma Carmen.
You're too young to be grandma.
Well,
you're making that up.
We will talk about that at another time. That will be the subject of another conversation.
Yes, we're old-fashioned names.
I love it. Okay, so when you think about your grandchildren, tell me about your hopes for them and the country in which they live 30, 40, 50 years from now, and the concerns that you have about trends that you see now for the years ahead.
I want the country to be the country that was envisioned by the framers of the Constitution and the magnificent words of the preamble, setting forth the purposes of government and the closing purpose of government, of this new government at the time under the Constitution of the United States was to secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and our posterity. So I want them to continue to live in the sweet land of liberty. Here it's about freedom, and so may they be inheritors of a culture of freedom, but freedom under law, not freedom to do anything that you want to do. I might want to drive my new Toyota Camry 130 miles an hour. Well, it wouldn't go that fast. But even if I wanted to do that, I shouldn't do that. Why not? There are rules of the road. So liberty under law, liberty not license. And so I hope we will continue to have what Justice Cardozo so eloquently called ordered liberty. And that's very biblical, isn't it? For freedom, Christ has set us free, but not freedom to do anything that we want to do, but to enjoy, from a Christian perspective, human flourishing, to use our talents, the God-given talents. I love the parable of the talents. When I was a college president, I would frequently talk about the College of the Talents. That's a good name for a college. The parable of the talents. You have been given gifts. It's not money. You've been given these gifts, these abilities, these interests, and so forth. So now the moral duty is on you to identify those talents and then to use those talents. So that's the kind of country I want my wonderful seven grandchildren, our wonderful seven grandchildren, to live in and enjoy.
And trends that you see today that concern you?
The hostility to religion and overall secularization of society is of concern. But people, I believe, in freedom of conscience. So let's all learn to live with our deepest differences together. Stop yelling at one another on college campuses. Let's treat one another with dignity and respect. And quite relevantly, that means we don't take advantage of people in terms of vulnerabilities that we see all too frequently, as well as a regime and culture of freedom of speech, that the answer to speech with which you disagree is more speech. That's the great traditional vision of our constitutional order, and there are real pressures on that right now. And colleges and universities all too frequently are allowing speakers to be shut down, and that is just wrong. So I hope all seven grow up to be college presidents who end up doing the right thing in the right way.
Well, amen. Ken Starr, what an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much. We look forward to the book, Contempt, a memoir of the Clinton investigation, coming out very soon. You can pre-order it at Amazon. Ken Starr, thank you so much for being with us today on Connecting Faith.
Thank you, Carmen. My pleasure.
Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge. We are, I wish I had a horse to saddle up. That's kind of how I feel today. Wouldn't that be fun this weekend, saddle up a horse? Hey, the Minnesota State Fair just started. I bet there's some people saddling up horses there. I probably need to hear more about that. So you can tweet me from the fair, at Carmen LaBurge. You can email me from the fair. I'm Carmen at myfaithradio.com. You can find me on Facebook, Instagram, like, right? It would be really fun to have some state fair interaction. My guess is you can get God back into the conversations at the Minnesota State Fair if you try. So there you go. I am going to want some news I can use from the mission field of the Minnesota State Fair. Are you with me? I think this should be the Connecting Faith challenge for all listeners attending the Minnesota State Fair, or, you know, frankly, any other state fair. I'm pretty much a fair person. Like, I don't really think there's a bad time of day to eat a corn dog, just personally. So there you go. Fair food, fair fun. Give it to me all. All right. Give it all to me. Okay. So, because that's listener engagement. And actually, when we talk about making the connecting point, that's actually really what we're trying to do. So let me share with you. I got a lot of listener input this past week, which I totally love. So let me share with you. One listener shared this. She is in the process today of moving her firstborn child into his college dorm. And she shared this. I'm simply reflecting from my hotel room. Move-in is today. Why does my heart feel like it's going to stop? I can't breathe. Dropping off your firstborn at college. Gosh, the emotion of this rite of passage is not over all laughter and fun times that you had together on vacations or even memories from all the accomplishments that you celebrated with them. My heart simply feels like it's going to stop. I'm reflecting on the 18 or so years that we've had together, all the times in between, the valleys we went through with him, the tears I cried over his disappointments and his hurts, the late night talks we had over the years, the weary but important work of disciplining and training in the early years, and then the coaching and mentoring as he got older. Sometimes it was listening and just being still in the middle of hard things that I simply had to let be hard. Some of the hard things eventually turned out into things, especially lessons learned, helping him now make him who he is today. I simply could not have done this on my own. We could not have done this on our own. Many times we tried. We certainly needed God. And then something that's a little difficult to decipher. And then I'll say this. She goes on to say, I constantly asked God for help and models for my kids to follow. I want people to know we can't do the important job of parenting on our own. It's simply impossible. No human being has the patience, nor the humility, nor the endurance to do this in their own flesh. But God and godly friends who will walk this journey with us, even now into the next season of launching, I'm preparing him for it all, and God is even now preparing me. So she's sharing that because I was talking about issues related to going back to school and things that our kids are experiencing in school and at school that maybe we did not experience in school or at school when we were growing up. And so I want to raise some back-to-school issues here briefly, in part so we can be praying around these issues, and in part so that we can be thinking about how do we lean into these conversations? How do we press into these conversations? One of the things going on in many of our schools this year that is new is that bathrooms are almost now universally accessible to students who identify with a gender other than their biological agenda, other than their biological gender, which means that in elementary, middle, and high schools, and certainly colleges across the country, folks are going to be entering into bathrooms and finding people there who are not of their same biological gender. I had another listener who emailed in response to this conversation the other day that I had with Alexis Lightcap, and I highly encourage you to go back and go to myfaithradio.com, listen to my conversation with Alexis. She's going to be a college freshman, and when she was in high school, this happened to her. She walked into the girls' room, and there is a biological male in the bathroom, and now she is engaged in a federal lawsuit related to that. So, you know, she believes that her own privacy and the dignity of her own body and as a person of faith, her right to not have a person of a different gender, sex, see her body until she decides she's going to share that with her husband. Like, right, all of those things are important in this conversation. And so anyway, a mom emailed in reaction in response to that and said, just a different mom than the mom whose email I was just reading. And this mom said, hey, we just dropped our daughter off at college. And like most colleges, she is now in a dorm that has both men and women. She, you know, and so it's like every other room is boys and girls. And then the bathroom is also non-gender specific, let's say. It's just the hall bathroom and it's just for everybody. And so she talked about, like, you know, how they thought they had prepared her for that. And I'm thinking to myself, I don't know that I would have comfortably left my kid there. Like, it's hard. We're living in really challenging times in terms of how it is we're going to prepare our kids to live in the world that they are inheriting. And so I want us to lean into those conversations. Another conversation that I want you to lean into as Christians in your own local community, which I think we need to be leaning into the conversation with our local schools, elementary and on up, on the question of bathroom access. I think we have to lean into that conversation. I also think we have to lean into the conversation about what's happening at school lunch and the shaming that kids are experiencing in relationship to school lunch. And so I just want you to go to the closest school, the whatever school that you have to slow down, you know, right? The flashing lights right now, 15 miles per hour, you have to slow down anyway. So just go ahead and pop in, stop in and ask the principal or ask the social worker or ask the lunch lady. You could pretty much ask anybody that you can find. What's the situation in our local school in relationship to kids experiencing shaming at lunch? Like, I hear this in the news. I want to know what's happening here, and I want to help. At our local school, that we have something called the share table. And if you're a member of the local community, you can drop off fruit or, you know, or other healthy things, and they're just on the share table. And so kids can stop by and get something off the share table if they don't have enough in their lunch that day, or if what's being served at lunch from school is not something that they find yummy. So there you go. A share table is an easy solution. Local communities and churches are actually filling lots of other needs. There's a really great effort going on in Des Moines, and it's and you can find it, an article about it in the Des Moines Register. Actually, really some really cool articles in the Des Moines Register about stuff going on there. There's another one that I want to lift up next week about a high school student who, you know, he only has one arm, and he's now mentoring this little boy who also only has one arm. And for this little boy, it's the first time in his life that he's ever felt good about himself because he finally knows somebody who's like him or he's like. And I can't talk about it today because I'm going to cry, but I'll work on my ability to talk about it next week. But anyway, you can find that in the Des Moines Register as well. But there's a celebration in the Des Moines Register about ways that donations in that community are really making a difference across the state of Iowa, talking about backpacks, talking about food, and talking about clothing. So I want you to just think about that. Maybe you're past the stage of life where you have to actually go and buy those school supplies for somebody in your own family. Think about going and buying school supplies anyway. Go and just buy the whole list of whatever it is that a kid in a particular grade in a particular school needs where you live, and then go drop it off to that teacher. Because I guarantee you, he or she is going to have a student in their classroom this year that shows up with no school supplies. And there's a lot of shame in not having what you need, and there's a lot of dignity in having what you need. And you can just put it all in a backpack and drop it off. You can also just go to your local school and tell them you're willing to help. And find out what that means. Maybe they just need somebody to read to kids. Maybe they need somebody to sit at the corner of the park. I have no idea what your school needs, and I don't presume to know. But I guarantee you, your school knows what it needs. And so go and offer yourself up. And then I want you to think about just this time of year being a really good time of year to make your own personal reset. And this is sort of the connecting point for each and every one of us. It's time to go back to school. If you have not been, you know, reading your Bible, now's the time to restart reading your Bible. Go back to school. Discipleship is a lifelong process of learning, becoming more and more conformed to the image of who Christ is. And we discover the truth of who Christ is through the scriptures of the Old and New Testament. Jesus is the living Word. He is the Word made flesh. And so he's revealed throughout the scriptures. It's not as if, you know, God hatches a redemptive narrative at the conception and birth of Jesus. No. Jesus is eternally the second member of the Trinity. He is eternally the Word of God. At one point in history, he took on human flesh to dwell among us and do for us what we could not do for ourselves. It's never a wrong time to restart a Bible reading plan. So, you know, the first of the year is a great time to start some things. And this back to school time is a really good opportunity to restart some things. So if you're not actively engaged in a Bible reading plan or in a Bible study, soaking up the scriptures, now's the time to jump back in. I'd also say now's a good time to go back to the basics. Prayer, worship, scripture recitation, memorization, fellowship, accountability, all of that. Get in there. Become activated as a disciple of Jesus Christ in order that the gospel might be advanced right now. Because, you know, if we're not advancing the gospel in this culture, I can assure you that the enemy is going to seek to advance his agenda to steal, kill, and destroy that which is good. And those little sheep out there whom the good shepherd would very much like for you and I to be reaching with the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ. All right, friends. So it's time to get back to the basics and back to the Bible and frankly, back to the business. On purpose and on mission, the Great Commission and the Great Commandment. You know what they are. Now let us go out there and live them. Hey, send me news from the State Fair. I'm at Carmen LaBerge on Twitter. I'm also at Carmen LaBerge and the Reconnect with Carmen online or on Facebook. Email Carmen at myfaithradio.com. Have a great weekend and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.